Greetings and welcome to the Destination Goa Trends podcast, bringing in-depth interviews with artists, label people, organizers from the golden age of the 90s to the modern era. My name is Simon Peter and I'm here with the one and only Tibus.
Awesome! Let's talk about Goa Trends. But before we do that, let me remind you to hit the like button and share the show so that new people can tune in. Peter, do you know which was the first ever Goa Trends label?
Of course, it was Dragonfly Records, launched in 1993 in London. It was ran by Martin Glower, aka Youth, who was already a well-established musician and producer, and also one of the pioneer DJs of the UK electronic music scene. He then went to India, visited one of the beach parties in Goa, and, as they say, the rest is history.
Well, before Goa Trends, you started as a bass player of Killing Joke in the late 70s. After leaving the band, he started multiple projects, including Brilliant together with Ben Watkins of Juno Reactor, Stefan from Total Eclipse, and Jimmy Cotti of the KLF. He also became a sought-after remixer and producer, producing A-list stars and making remixers for acts like the U2. But he also took part in the writing process of the first The Orb album and had a label together with Alex Peterson. After his experience in Goa, he started working on a label and a compilation to showcase the sound of Goa to a wider world. He gathered a bunch of talented producers and engineers around him in his London studio named Butterfly. Legends of the scene like Simon Bosford, Ott, Man With No Name were all dipping their toes into the developing Goa trance sound under his wings. Later, he created Liquid Sound Design label for his own downtempo output and released multiple genius psychedelic dub albums. Today, both Dragonfly and Liquid Sound Design are active again.
We had a short window of time between recording sessions to talk to him and poke his memories of the early days of the scene and the inception of Dragonfly Records. So without further ado, let's hear it directly from Youth himself. Why don't we just jump in there and start in the beginning. So where did your fascination for electronic and psychedelic music come from?
Yeah, I think I suppose from the 70s, really, you know, Pink Floyd, Tangerine Dream, I Feel Love, Donna Summer, high energy disco in the late 70s, and some of the electronic punk like The Normal, A Fat Gadget, early Human League. Yeah, all that was quite inspiring. And of course, Killing Joke had an electronic element with we had a synth player and a keyboard player, Jazz Coleman, who's, you know, still one of my favorite keyboard players, actually amazing.
Yeah, he was also the vocalist in the band, right?
Initially we shared all the vocals and then he became the vocalist, yeah. But he's a great synth player, fantastic. And very distinctive. If you listen to Killing Joke's first album, like Requiem, starts with this pulse. And yeah, I enjoyed that. And, you know, very quickly in the early 80s with Brilliant, we had other keyboard players. I was doing early electronic music with Ben Watkins as the DJ Breakbeat album. That was very impactful. Emerging industrial and electronic music then, feature bands like 400 Blows, 23 Skidoo. It was quite dark and that was quite popular down at the Batcave. I just went to a talk on the Batcave. Batcave was this goth club in the mid 80s that started goth, and but also had a broad spectrum. They play a lot of electronic music and have electronic bands that Ignore the Machine, Alien Sex Fiends, very electronic single, which was a big anthem down there that I produced. And I was also working with bands like on the Batcave compilation, Young Limbs, Test Department, early industrial things. Of course, actually in Goa, when I first went to Goa in 89, there was quite a strong industrial edge to a lot of the music then, which included bands that sounded similar to Split Second and Eat Swerve, the Belgium New Beat thing, which was a sort of side wing of early industrial, but a precursor to the German EBM, electric body music thing, which came in with DAF and the German late 80s Palais Schomburg. And that directly led into their techno element with Sun Electric and the whole Berlin scene. And I was quite involved with them through my own label with Alex Patterson. While Mr. Murdo, we put out a Loco by Sun Electric and other Sun Electric, Thomas Follman electronic projects. And people cite that as being the birth of Berlin's electronic techno scene, those records, those guys, actually. So that's really significant. And I think that early Goa sound did have a strong electronic element. But then it was... it was just kind of like radio. A lot of the records then in Goa were very rudimentary electronic. They reminded me of like early Depeche Mode or even some of the earlier Acid House, like Adamski type tunes, just looped very primitively and incessantly. I think that was to create that sort of repetitive trance element that works well when you're taking psychedelics. But it was an aesthetic. It took me a little while to get my head around because I'd just come from the second summer of love in London with Acid House and Ian St. Paul's Club, Spectrum, the rave phenomena coming out of that very quickly. In 89, 90, free parties I was putting on, illegal parties in the woods and countryside with Ian then. And so that was a much more sophisticated sound, actually, on Acid House. And it included that Balearic sound, which was kind of cheesy indie music in a way that you could listen to by the pool in Ibiza that could somehow work well on the dance floor in Future or Spectrum. It was eclectic. And I think that was a bit of a hangover from the New York Paradise garage scene, but it's interesting. That didn't work in Goa because it was too commercial sounding and it had vocals and stuff like that. Goa, it'd been distilled down to its sort of bone-less essence. But of course, very quickly, coming back from Goa the first year in 1990, I mean, that first year I met a lot of DJs there and they all had books of their sets or their fans did, listing all the set lists going back 4 or 5 years. And looking at those set lists, I realized many of those records that were big anthems there were from my records of Heavy Duty Breaks, Empty Quarter, Glass Finger, and that was one of Gil's favourites, Glassfinger, and also a big chunk of the Wow Modo catalogue, many of which of those records didn't sell anything at the time, but are connected and being re-edited and put together on cassette in Goa, and they kind of become big anthems. So I was welcomed very warmly there. And that immediately gave me a sort of a penetration into those DJs' mindsets. And many of them actually had a very broader perspective. Funny, Hamish, the DJ at the Batcave, who'd also been in Gong and was from New Yorker via London, he had a picture on his presentation of he'd list his bets and his records in his notebook, and he'd work out the BPMs with his second hand on his watch and write the BPMs down. And I was like amazed. I said, what, in 1984, you were working with BPMs, with punk records and things? And he was like, yeah. But he'd arranged them into categories, early, faster, you know, tempo. A lot of the Goa DJs I met early on had done the same thing, and they had cassettes that were like yellow. That was early evening and then peak evening. And they were all different tempos around the same tempo. And then the dark before the dawn and then the fluffy bit of dawn. And that they didn't really know what the tracks were called sometimes. especially some of the Israeli DJs, didn't have a clue that they just had them as BPMs and color coded them. And I thought, wow, these DJs aren't really like DJs in London, which are like crate digger collectors. They're like, I was a train spotter when I was a kid. I'd stand on platforms watching, collecting the numbers of the diesel electric trains engines going by, you know. And then I was a stamp collector. Collecting was a big thing in the UK when I was a kid. So, you know, when I got into music and vinyl, collecting vinyl and the names and knowing everything about it was a big part of it. But in Goa, it had been abandoned a few stages before, and it was just what facilitated their set at the time. I thought that was a bit iffy, to be honest. But sometimes those guys did really cool sets. So, I mean, they still brought this sort of shamanic intuition to it. But yeah, it was odd. And I thought some of the production values with the music was, I mean, I quite liked that it was raw and lo-fi and punk rock, but over 4 hours, you'd be fatiguing on the ears. You really wanted to hear some beautiful sounds, you know. And the only guy who could really deliver that was Laurent, I thought, who was the best DJ by a long shot. He was so popular that all the bars and cafes and the local mafias would stop other people's parties to make sure that his party went ahead. And he had put so much pressure on him to have parties because he pulled the biggest crowds and they sold the most amount of beer and stuff. And eventually kind of withdrew from that. But he was phenomenal. One of the best DJs I've ever, ever experienced. And still blows me away when I think about some of those parties I went to with him. It's just mind-blowing. And then, of course, I think the following year, or maybe by 92, 93, DAT machines were coming in. And suddenly the town was much, much better. And also, I'd gone straight back to London and recalibrated my Brixton studio Butterfly with all this Indian furniture and Indian hangings. I'd rented a house for 10 years in India at that point. I was buying a lot of stuff. I was making a lot of money as a producer and remixer. And so I recalibrated the studio, which had five studios in it, towards making records that would work out there. I even had Mr. and Mrs. Chan, Indian cooks, come in to provide an ashram atmosphere and a free meal for everybody working in the studio every night. And we did some legendary parties where we'd have up to 600-800 people outside, and I'd do an LSD punch with ecstasy, and they were legendary parties. And they definitely changed the culture and the scene, and facilitated a lot of these disparate engineers and artists into this new scene. And that combined with Ian running the label and helping with the A&R and directing them on the music, created, you know, the First Order Odinata. Prior to that, though, we had Electrotet on Wamodo, which was one of the first tunes I heard in India. And weirdly, it transcribed, it was made by Ben and Stefan, who had both been in my indie dance band, Brilliant, the band I started after coming to. So there's a lot of serendipity there. And we put that out and didn't do anything. And then I got into trouble going back to Goa the following year because I called one of the mixes Anjuna Dawn. And some of these hardcore Goa freaks were like, oh, you can't tell anyone about this place. You can't mention the name on record sleeves. And I said, it's too late. I've got 50 DJs coming out. all my eyes are on the way, you know. And I said, look, my job is to promote this, you know, not to keep it into this secret elite. And it'll do what it's going to do. But the world needs this sort of energy, and it has to go out there. And eventually they kind of got with the program and everybody enjoyed it. But that then facilitated a lot of those artists really calibrating the sound. Prior to that, me and Ian would just go in and play them tracks and say, look, I want this. Or I'd play one of the very first tracks. In fact, the track Ian says became the template for the next 3 or 4 years was on the previous album before Odinata, which was Trance Volume 2, which is Dragonfly Trance Volume 2. I don't know why we called it Volume 2, but it was
Project to Trance, or was it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and that was straight after I came back from Goa, before Ian got involved, and the Paul Jackson tune on their transmission.
Yeah,
which is basically me in a studio at Butterfly with one of my assistants playing and What Time Is Love, you know, by Taylor. Mm-hmm. I did something like this, but with a different beat that goes and a bit more spacey. And so, I mean, and that became actually the go-to reference. There are other tracks on there that are great and were hammered in Goa as well. But then not quite as genre-defining as that one became. And then you hear that echoed in the First Order Ordinata, where it really defines that sound and the beginnings of what was to come. And then I think that was the real peak of the scene then, from 93 to 96. Very quickly, the scene splintered into a dozen other labels with hundreds of other DJs and bands and everybody jumping on it, and big, big events in London, official and unofficial, at Brixton Academy and all over Europe and America. I started to get DJing gigs in America. Had a residency at Twilo, and I did 5 a.m. till 7 a.m. just playing hard trance, and a couple of other clubs, Limelight and other ones, and I'll be going out there every other month, you know. And that was like hard trance. It was weird because there didn't seem to be that many go-aheads or freaks there, but everybody knew that sound and they loved it. And it was, they put me on so late because that's when all the, I see these lines forming on the dance floor, and I go to the promoter, I say, "What's that?" And he goes, "Oh, that's the line for the drug dealer." It'd be all the freaks who wanted the drugs would kick in then about 5 a.m. and then go really hard through my set. So, you know, it really became an explosion. But I think by 96, 97, it started to get a bit darker and the production values got a bit more, almost like heavy metal or something. But suddenly everyone's trying to make these really dark, you know, and busy soundtracks. And I kind of found it, I didn't like it so much. I mean, I'd signed Spiral Tribe to Butterfly, and that was hardcore GABA, you know, techno, and I found that hard to listen to as well. But I didn't want to turn Spiral Tribe into Goa Trance. I left them to do what they wanted to do as they did it and not interfere. Although in the book recently that came out about them, they're saying, "We regret you didn't get more involved with the production." But you know, in a lot of cases with Dragonfly as well, I just provide and facilitate a studio and an oversight as A&R and a label to allow those artists to do what they wanted to do, you know. And that was quite unique, I think. And that created a whole genre. But I must admit, by the end of the 90s, I was very disengaged. Although when Darren Stubbs, Dazzle, was managing the label in the middle, we started another label, Camouflage, which was more minimal. Had the artists like James Monroe, and all those labels emerged out of Butterfly Studios, Flying Rhino, Tip, loads from Blue Room. And it all started with a lot of our original Dragonfly artists. And I think by 97, yeah, I mean, some of the more older heads wanted a more minimal sound and a more fluid sound. And I think that's kind of became really kind of cool, actually. And you hear it a lot now in more down-tempo sort of trance sets. And I really like that. And then we also, at the same time, started Liquid Sound around then to facilitate a more ambient chill-out sound to it, coming from the Orb and the Little Fluffy Clouds. That made a lot of sense, as I was quite, you know, central to that. And of course, some of those albums become classics, and that created a whole genre. Also, while I was doing the events and parties, I'd introduce heads to do talks. Terence McKenna, really significant people, were Fraser Clark from Megatripolis, people from the 60s, really, who I felt could benefit my generation's wave of underground psychedelia with some of their experiences. So there wasn't always a strong connection to those eras. But Hoppy, John Hopkins particularly, who'd run the UFO Club in 69, where the London Summer of Love kicked off, he was coming to Dragonfly parties. He was still taking LSD in the 90s. So he was definitely warmly invited and would do talks and tell us about the kind of community elements and the cultural elements that you wouldn't always recognize with scenes like that, and the responsibilities of that, I think, which I tried hard to reflect within the events. So you'd have the talks and information. There might be even better theater and art gallery shows, and then maybe some dub, and then it would get into the trance about 11 midnight, and then that would go through till 9 in the morning or something, you know. Those events, that sort of format has become very popular. And I've noticed that this summer in a lot of festivals in the UK, everywhere, you know, the combination of those three, you know, intellectual stimulation from heads, talks, chill out spaces, and other kinds of music and performance art, and then some banging dance music, you know. Also, I mean, you see that everywhere, especially in Azora. Azora are very good at combining that with the gallery and having kind of find a broad spectrum, even though it's very trance-centric, you know.
Yeah, I think these days it's mostly like a festival experience. Like if you go to an everyday or a weekend party, you get less of the multicultural experience. Of course, the visuals are still a big part of it. It's an important element of a party, but you get maybe less of the talks, less of the spiritual element directly injected into the party, unless there is an organizer who is really keen on like adding these elements in. When do you think this got kind of lost from the culture, or why was it so important back then? I mean, obviously, as it was kind of re-imported into the UK from Goa, it initially had these elements, but there was, it seems, a fertile ground already. There was some previous knowledge of this, like you mentioned, from the late 60s, there was an aptitude for this culture.
It's always been there, you know. I mean, it goes back hundreds of thousands of years. Goa Gil was very articulate in expressing it as redefining the shamanic ritual for the 21st century. I mean, that's what it is. Yep. So that underground psychedelia, but it's through Greeks, Elysium, rites, European, Bohemia, Berlin 20s, 60s, beatniks in America, hippies in the 60s, punks, 70s. I mean, it's all part of the same river of culture, you know. Actually, Chet Helms, who'd started the Family Dog in the West Coast in the 60s, which was big Avalon Ballroom, or the big Deadhead, you know, events initially. He'd studied classical Greek philosophy and history, and I interviewed him. I've got a book coming called Freaks of Philosophy with a lot of the heads we invite to these events, and it's all about their philosophy. And he said that his inspiration was the ancient Greek idea of a sanctuary and debates, and you know, and then if you go further east to India, you have Darshan with the gurus. They're all very connected. Into Africa, they have a similar thing. And I think in modern Western culture, it's been forgotten a lot and replaced by a fairly bland Christian religion. I mean, not so much in London, we're very multicultural, but certainly, I mean, even in Spain, less than 2% of the population go to church anymore. In the UK, I think it's around the same. So there's a vacuum of spiritual expression in the UK. It's been replaced by political science and things like that. That doesn't really heal the soul or facilitate the journey of the soul in the way shamanic practices can, or even archetypal ideas like journey through the underworld and the Greek that sort of thing. These are all echoed in the DJ sets and the nights, really, and also in the artwork that came with them in the 90s. And still, and I think it's that's facilitating a huge kind of spiritual renaissance towards pagan ideas and philosophies of nature-based spirituality. And that's just huge. And I think, weirdly enough, electronic music really taps us into a kind of organic part of our universal nature. Even though it's kind of electronic and artificial, there's something organic about it, especially with the modular things. Yeah, I mean, it's just really, I distill it down to sort of, it's like qualia, Sufi ideas. It's all about getting into a trance and losing our sense of identity through the music and trance, tapping into collectives and music and tone and frequency. Frequency is really important. Frequency, the spaceships we travel on to go through those rites of passage. And I think, actually, if you go back to 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, all the Neolithic chambers and cairns were all tuned to 111 kilohertz mainly. And they would have used sound with that frequency as part of their initiation ceremonies for sure. You get a standing wave feedback at that frequency, like in Knoll, Newgrange in Ireland, there's a window above the door and that chamber's full of smoke, and the smoke comes out with that frequency affecting it. It will bring it out in a serpentine wave. If you've got a couple of thousand people watching the equinox dawn, serendipitously, it's the equinox now, yesterday, they will see a light and sound show akin to Pink Floyd and the Orb, you know, with the Bunrai sun coming up and the smoke coming out like a dragon, serpentine dragon, and the feedback frequency would make 12 people sound like 30, you know. And it would have been a spectacle and was designed as that, to create shock and awe and allow you to penetrate that moment, that natural moment of equinox or solstice, even deeper. And I think in many ways, just observing those things through the wheel of the year really kind of brings your psyche into sync with nature and things, and that can be really inspiring and healing and totally a way of detoxifying from the virtual digital world we find ourselves in, and the reality of existential dread of being human and knowing we're gonna die and what does that mean, and all that stuff comes into it. But ultimately, you know, you can take LSD and not have a spiritual experience. You can have just a sound and light show that's entertaining. Same with other drugs. It's not integral to that experience. In fact, in Goa, a lot of the people who would be dancing the longest were the sannyasins down from Pune, who wouldn't take drugs at all, and they would dance nonstop for 6 hours. The drugs can confuse things. They can open doors, but they can leave you physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually a bit charred. Nevertheless, we're creatures of curiosity, and we want to explore, and we want to get high, and we want to feel those feelings, we want to enter those other dimensions, and we will always be doing that, I'm sure. That is part of the tradition too, but it's not the entire story.
And how do you remember, how did the Goa attitude spread in the really early days, before you, around when you established Dragonfly, maybe when the first compilations were released? How were the parties? How were the people reacting to this new music that was never before heard?
Well, there was a little bit of an underground scene in London anyway. Tip were already doing parties, but maybe just 100 people. But they were evangelical, and they're very hard to get into. So there was a little awareness, but people coming out of rave and acid house were already tuned to those frequencies a bit anyway. This was taking them a bit further, deeper down into a psychedelic bedrock, you know, cut out a lot of the more commercial elements. Also, you'd have punches like in Goa, so people would all come up on the same high at the same time or around the same time. And that was very bonding. And I think eventually, if you allowed yourself to let go of your preconceptions and just go with the beats and the music and the DJs, you will get to that point of transcendence, which was the whole point. Nevertheless, for some people, I remember my very first party I went to, and I went with three friends, English people I met in India traveling. I knew one of them, two of them actually from London. And four of us in Thailand, it was a Goa Gil party. And two of us got it and stayed all night, and two of us didn't, and they left early. And I found with everyone I invited out, not everyone got it. I mean, probably about 30% actually really got it. The rest was a nice experience, but that wasn't it. So I think, again, looking back in history, it's not, it has had moments of mass popular explosion, but often it is in the fringes of counterculture. And that's more of a select minority to the mainstream. Nevertheless, you see, the culture we're in now is a culture of niches, where a niche like psychedelic trance can facilitate a festival like Azora. That's pretty mainstream. And you see some of the artists who have blown up out of psychedelic trance become mainstream, you know, million seller artists, you know. So, you know, there are different tangents to it than maybe from the 60s or the 70s punk or whatever, but generally they say they follow an archetypal route. And what's amazing about psychedelic trance is it just gets bigger, maybe because it hasn't been overly commercialized. There's never been much media. It's never been featured in many magazines or other TV media. And it's always retained an underground mystique because of that. Also, it's never been hip to hipster aficionados in the city of London. And even when it was massive in the 90s, it was definitely the object, the target of much scorn and derision from emerging East London hipsters, you know, and house enthusiasts or whatever. But I've always argued, and that found true when I was DJing in New York and London at that time, that some people are taking certain drugs, they're taking a lot of psychedelics. Eventually, you have to go to that place of pure trance. Even if you're a house DJ like Darren Emerson or someone like that, when he's doing a two-hour, three-hour, 3 a.m. set in Tokyo or London or somewhere, the difference between that and some of the trance sets you'll hear in Azora isn't that much, because that's the only place you can go, actually. You know, it's a distillation alchemical process, and that, you know, eventually you take out all those other elements, you're left with psychedelic trance. Obviously, there's cliche trance. I mean, I can barely go near the main stage in Azora because it's all 150 BPM galloping, giddy up trance, you know, that just sounds like some kids' TV show or something to me now. I just can't. I find it really hard to see it. So, not to say there are some artists that play at that speed that I'm like, wow, that's amazing. Ben Watkins, for example, can deliver something like, wow, out that tempo. But very few of those producers can. And I think even at 140, he's kind of pushing it. And I much prefer trance that's more like 126, you know, 124, 126 now. And I always have, you know, so that's just personal taste, though, I think, because it still remains very, very popular. The faster stuff, you know, and the stuff I like is much more niche and isn't so popular. So, but I don't really care.
Yeah, but the problem is that nobody plays that type of music. So it's actually, we don't know whether people would love it or listen to it because nobody plays it.
Well, that's a big, you've identified a big problem with a lot of the DJs on the scene now. They don't play other people's music. They just play their own sets. And they may call it a live set and get a bit more money for that, or they just do a DJ set and they just play their last bangers they've made for the last 2 years or a history of. And you've still got a few DJs that will play a lot of different kinds of music, but essentially that's dipped down to just DJs promoting their own music. That's fine. If it's Man With No Name, I just want to hear a set of Man With No Name, really. I mean, but if it's, you know, what I loved about the great DJs of the scene of your one was the selection process. They would get the best of all the best. It wouldn't just be their personal best, it would be the best of the best, and that would fit their story. And of course, that's got to be better, I think. So, you know, often they're not listening to other people's music at all anymore. They're just, you know, making their own music.
It's interesting to kind of contrast this to the trends in the late 80s, early 90s. So you had this kind of wave of new music coming through the US, the American Midwest, like Chicago, and the East Coast, like New York, and then coming towards England with a little bit of a Balearic element as well from Ibiza, and then it arrives to the UK and it explodes. And the
Detroit techno was massive as well. And yeah, that was kind of interesting and kind of worked in a go away as many ways as well. It was fun.
Yeah, but it was interesting that in the US it was a local kind of thing. It was always like a small scene, then it arrives to England and it exploded on the world, basically.
London is the nexus. It's the nexus for many things and for trance. Kevin Saunderson coming to London and seeing 2,000 people go nuts, or Marsha Jefferson, to their records in Shum or Spectrum blew their minds. They were like, and then they had 10 years of like creaming hundreds of remix commissions off the back of it from British labels often. And everybody did well out of that. And London has a nexus point here because of many things. It's still a mystery, but it's more important than New York, LA, Paris, anywhere else for that kind of culture. And has been for a long time. You look what comes out of this city, from punk, blitz, new romantics, early electronic music, trance. I mean, all of it. It's small enough where something can go national here, but without it being taking too long. Whereas America, it takes a year or two for them to absorb anything new. So big, you know, sometimes Europe's like that as well, but the UK's an island, and it's small enough to be able to blow something up big, but small. And that's not just with the electronic dance music. I mean, that's a lot of bands had to make it here before they could make it back in America, whether it's Nirvana or Lenny Kravitz. If you can make it in London, you can. It used to be said, if you make it in New York, you make it anywhere. And that's true as well. But London particularly, if you can blow up here, you're pretty much guaranteed to blow up everywhere else in the world if they play the cards right. And I think that stands to the ethnicity and multiculturalness and the mashup of that in London. It is a city of immigrants, and it's a big city, and it's also a financial center, so people have money. And it's also been significant in other cultural ways, like with poetry, writing, film. All those things have been groundbreaking in some way here. And then also the thing with fashion and art schools and fashion colleges in London, combining with underground music, you get something like punk, you know, or, you know, and that's quite rare. It doesn't happen like that in other cities. I mean, it does, you know, New York is famous for their punk and doo-wop and lots of things culturally, but not quite in the same way as what London has done. And that makes it, like, you know, the best city in the world for me. And still blows me away. How much is going on here? A big city. But it's a city of villages, you know, that flow into each other. So you can create little local things that can then mycelium-like spread to other ones, and then you have a big city thing. And of course, other cities like Liverpool and Manchester have big musical heritages, and similar things happen there, but they all have to come to London to take it further, you know. And once you've done that, then you have to take America. That's another thing. That's not so easy. But even the Eagles had to make their records here and kind of get it right here before Paul Simon, all those guys. It's a phenomenon, London. And some dub DJs the other day were saying like London is the capital of dub because none of the international dub DJs will go to America. No one's going to America at the moment. So because of the ICE fascism that's happening there and the threat of being held in an ICE detention center at immigration, it's like, let's not go. So, you know, they're all coming to London, and London's actually getting a really good buzz because of that. And of course, London's full of Americans at the moment. A lot of Americans don't want to be in America either. So that's creating an interesting mix in the streets mm-hmm. and clubs and creating an interesting synergy and, you know, mash up.
So you did have this kind of intention with this kind of Western wave coming through California with the hippies through India, Goa, and then coming back to London to try to grow this thing with your own label, try to explode this into the world through the London scene. Was that already the vision back then, basically, to just show it to the world through this lens?
Goa and Ibiza are very connected. For European hedonists, winter in Goa, London or another city in Europe, get your jewelry together. They may then do the festivals in Europe and then end up in Ibiza, you know, for the summer. And that's been going since the 20s, 30s, I think, you know. Yeah, it's a good lifestyle. I'm very lifestyle orientated too, so... But London, you know, I've got a studio in Spain. I travel a lot. But London's always good to come back to. And London's where I can get really creative and focused. Despite all the detractions that I will get here, it's got an energy that really helps. So other times when I've been in America, America's often felt too big to be able to possible to penetrate at any level. And you're like... You're just going to be ground up by that machine in some way. Whereas London, you feel you can slip through the cracks a bit and achieve greatness in many ways. And it's not too inaccessible or difficult. I'm not so sure if that's true today, but it used to be.
Do you remember who drew the original Dragonfly logo? And why the name Dragonfly? You had the other label, Butterfly. Was that the reason that was called Butterfly? That's why you named this Dragonfly? Or where does the name all come from?
Butterfly was first. And Butterfly happened just before I kind of went through India. So Butterfly was my attempt to create a London 60s psychedelic hippie aesthetic in London with the studio, a cross between Apple and Motown or something, you know. Like the Apple Boutique or some of the Granny Takes a Trip shops, something very psychedelic, flamboyant, but still quite focused and professional. And then I went to India, and then that became overwhelmingly an Indian aesthetic, you know, which fitted into that as well, you know. And then I think while I was in India, I think I was doing a meditation in Arambol and this dragonfly sat on my finger or something, and I thought, oh yeah, this is it. And initially, I think the first dragonfly logo on Project 2 Trance was done by Madge, who'd done a lot of the orb artwork, Mad Art. And then one of his collaborators, Nick Burton, who's also been a drummer in the band Westworld and stuff, he was an orb associate. He did the butterfly logo, and then he redid it better a few years later. It was a bit more basic initially. But I don't know, 1991, I think I got Nick Seymour from Crowded House, who'd done a lot of the designs for Surfwear company, forget their name, but they were very popular with the Acid House kids, and they were very bright. Mambo, he'd done a lot of designs for Mambo company, and I said, oh, can you do me a Dragonfly logo? And he did, which was in a Mambo style, and that we used that for just a couple of releases. I think those were very rare releases now, and that was like a dragonfly with tower block wings or something. It was black and white. And then I think Nick also then redid the Dragonfly logo. But then I started working with Buggy G. Ripert, who'd done the Future Sound of London artwork and was using a lot of computer stuff. And from Order of Nata 2 onwards, he started doing the next five or six Order of Nata artworks, logos and designs. And that was a bit more Future Sound of London. And then when we started Liquid Sound Design, we were using Mark Neal, was a very important part of that story as a designer. And he'd done a lot of some of the Dragonfly stuff and was doing all of the Liquid Sound Design stuff. And he was also doing Hallucinogen and a lot of those label stuff. And he would take my drawings, my little ink drawings, and we'd use them as a series of artwork with his design on for a number of years. He retired many years ago, but he was very good. And he did the Celtic Cross album artwork. And I think also the Return to River Ganges, which preceded the Celtic Vedic album we did a few years ago. Part of that triptych of albums, but he didn't do that all right. But yeah, the aesthetic and the design was important, but it was fairly random. It wasn't really that well thought out. Well, I didn't have a manifesto or anything for the label politically, but I was going to do a book with Mark Neal about Butterfly, and we actually put it together and then just didn't publish it. And I think that will come out eventually. And that explained the philosophy of what I was trying to achieve with Butterfly and Dragonfly. Butterfly was a much broader label. We had Killing Joke, System 7, the Drum Club, which had come out of Spiral Tribe, and many other things, and Killing Joke. So it was quite a broader spectrum, whereas Dragonfly was specifically trance, Liquid Sound Design was specifically chill out.
Yeah, we wanted to talk a little bit about Black Sun, for example, which was your own output back in the day, how that comes. Yeah. Also the Devil Circus album.
Oh, Zodiac.
Yeah, Zodiac.
That's the artwork Buggy G gave me, which was the album sleeve for that. He ended up doing a big poster of it. I don't know if you can see it with the light, but next to the Jimmy Corti Acid Shield. Can you see that?
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah. And that was a picture of his corridor and his tower block. It was very dark. But that was a great album, a classic album, yeah. And I've just been mastering and mixing up a new Zodiac Youth album that's rock, it's not trance. That's taken 20 years to fulfill. And I dare say there'll be some trance mixes of that along the line as well. But those were just offshoot projects, really. I've just excuses to work with people I wanted to work with, like Zodiac. Black Sun was me more like my own sort of trance stuff. And I did a few other things under other names. But Robin at Liquid Sound Dragonfly now was saying she might want to do a compilation of some of those older tracks and unreleased ones, which would make sense. Dub Trees was my dub project. I haven't really branded those projects in the way that, like, the Orb or Spongle has become a brand. And that's possibly why they remain quite underground and unknown for most people. And yeah, but I suppose that's because I've got Killing Joke and, you know, other things to think about in that way. But yeah, I could have, it's also confusing for me and other people if I'm putting folk records out as youth or trance records out as youth or dub records out as youth. It's like, The only other person I know could kind of get away with that was Andrew Weatherall, you know. And we spent a lot of time together and worked alongside each other a long time, so that's similar. But yeah, I don't know. If you've got any clues of how I can improve that, let me know.
The old Dragonfly catalog is not available anywhere. Are there any plans with Robin to at least make them available digitally so that the now...
Yeah, sometimes. They've all kind of reverted back to the artist, which is right and proper in a way. But I think Robin's talking to some of them about re-releasing the very first Odonata or things like that. Yeah. But some are just so complicated, like Isla River Ganges is very, very difficult to get clearance on those things. That, yeah, some are just a moment in time, and they will remain very rare moment records or CDs for that reason. There's another thing I did, another name I used actually with Dragonfly was Transparent. There were a couple of tracks there that were really strong, I thought. I played one recently at Azora, actually, I think. And they kind of sound more like today than they did 10, 15 years ago. So I'm quite happy with that. I suppose one of my big inspirations is Lee Perry, you know, and he made thousands of albums, one of the most prolific producers, artists ever. And I've always liked the idea of making a lot of things under pseudonyms and just having a lot of records out there that aficionados and people can discover later on or collect later on or collect now. And, you know, I've been fortunate, and many of them are, that have become very collectible, so that's great. I'm always kind of, it's weird because even though I've run labels and I do A&R and I produce bands and artists, so I'm always looking ahead. I'm very lucky, not very often looking back, good at looking back and promoting or curating what we've done before in a new way, because I'm always too busy looking ahead. But I'm getting older now, and that's the time to reflect and reassess and revalue those things, and that's been good to do that. And because of that, there will be some like other older stuff coming up for sure.
That was our interview with Youth. We hope we can catch him once more to talk about his impact on the psychedelic downtempo scene as well. We hope you liked it.
Thanks for listening, people. If you enjoyed the podcast, hit the like button and be sure to subscribe and share the show. If you have any ideas, questions, leave a comment or message us on Facebook.